Protesters contrasted Iran's actions with those of the French foreign minister last week. After mentioning the possibility of placing sanctions on Israel over Gaza, he immediately backtracked the next day in front of Parliament.
The French government is quite the accomplice in the genocide that Israel is waging right now. Why aren't there any sanctions despite all these deaths? And when France talks so much about defending human rights, it's simply shameful.
French forces claim to have contributed to Israel's defense. In a major blow to perpetual Israeli hopes of escalating the violence, Washington has already refused to join any potential Israeli attack on Iran. It's uncertain if the cycle of Israeli assassination and Iranian retaliation is now concluded, but Israel has already returned to indiscriminate bombing and mass murder in Gaza, despite 6 months of global outrage, the murder of 34,000 Palestinians, and 76,000 injuries.
Will Israel pursue an even wider war? Will more Arab nations be inspired to join the cause of defending Gaza? What's certain is that many are happy that, for one night at least, the guns aimed at Gaza's civilians finally fell silent. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Pakistanis are showing staunch solidarity with the Iranian retaliatory strikes against the Israeli-occupied territories. Social media platforms overflow with messages of congratulations for Iran's effective response to Israel's atrocities, hailing Iran as a courageous champion of Muslim states willing to confront a Zionist regime, especially following months of atrocities against the Gaza Strip.
We are proud of Iran for taking a stand against Israel's aggression. The Palestinians have been suffering for decades, and it's time someone took action to protect them. Iran's attack shows that they won't tolerate the oppression any longer.
I fully support Iran's decision to strike back against Israel. The Palestinians have been living under siege for decades, and it's high time someone stood up for them. Iran's actions give hope to oppressed people everywhere.
The Pakistani government has echoed both the sentiments of its citizens and voiced grave concerns over escalation of tensions in the Middle East. Islamabad underscored the Israeli blockade of Gaza as a significant factor contributing to the recent wave of tensions, emphasizing the urgent need for international intervention to prevent further escalations in the region.
Iran has done the right thing legally and morally because Iran has retaliated against Israeli unwarranted aggression and attack on Iranian diplomatic installation in Damascus. And that was a violation of UN Charter and international law. So what Iran has done is the right thing. They have responded in kind and they have taken the battle to the aggressor and they have hit Israel.
The people of Pakistan emphasize the urgent need for global intervention to halt the escalation of conflict in the region and call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
Iran's attack on Israeli-occupied territories has garnered widespread support from Pakistanis, particularly due to their perceived alignment with the plight of people in Gaza. The warm reception of Tehran's operation by the Pakistani nation highlights its desire for a more assertive response to Israel's ongoing atrocities against Palestinians. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
German police have stormed the pro-Palestine conference in the capital Berlin and arrested a number of participants. The Palestine Congress was an important event for the Palestinian solidarity movement in Europe. It was set to be held in the German capital from April 12 to 14. The participants aimed to denounce Israeli apartheid and genocide and Germans' complicity in the genocide of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
We are the Palestine Congress. We accuse the Israeli state of carrying out genocide. And we accuse the German government of supporting, of abetting, of making possible this genocide.
On Friday afternoon, several hundred activists assembled in South Berlin to attend the conference. Soon after the conference started, it was interrupted by the city's police, which had dispatched more than 900 police officers to the area. Outside the conference venue, police officers arrested a man for hoisting a Palestinian flag on a building. The participants inside the conference venue also faced repression. Even the registered journalists were refused entry by the police officers who had been deployed inside the conference hall.
I was in the list, and as the moment as I came, they told me I'm not allowed to enter because there were too many people already inside.
The first part of the conference focused on the history of Palestine.
May marks 76 years since the Palestinian Nakba. 76 years of colonization, of forced exile. However, next month also marks 76 years of resilience, 76 years of a struggle for liberation.
The German police stormed the event during a speech by the Palestinian researcher Salman Abu Sitta, who addressed the conference via video link because he had been not allowed to enter Germany. Police said he was subject to a ban on political activity in the country.
The Palestine Congress was happening. We were watching a video. The police came and shut down the electricity. They didn't give a justification about it. They didn't tell us why. Nevertheless, the police came here, shut it down, said it in the loudspeaker. People are supposed to leave the building right now. You see, they're already taking people.
Chaotic scenes followed. At least two people were arrested inside the hall and several others were interrogated. German Interior Minister Nancy Faeser hailed the police, saying it was good how the police had reacted.
An hour after the start of the conference, German police stormed the conference hall because of a speech on the history of Palestine. In an act of extreme repression, they broke up the conference, declaring it an illegal assembly. However, the Palestine Solidarity Movement vows to continue the conference. Dieter Reinisch from Berlin.
Just one day after France's foreign minister earned praise for saying that sanctions on Israel could be coming over their refusal to allow humanitarian aid to Gaza, he quickly backtracked in a session before Parliament. Many are saying the episode revealed the uniquely powerful sway Zionism has in France.
France, although it has the biggest Jewish community in Europe, has also the most extreme right-wing anti-Palestinian Jewish community in Europe. And this community, this Jewish community in France, has a lot of saying and a lot of control over the media, over the political class. So you have very few people within this community who are protesting what's going on in the Middle East. Not like the United States and Great Britain.
The majority of France's Jews fled from former French colonies in Africa once those countries gained independence in the 1950s and 1960s, and they reportedly brought with them stringent anti-Arab and pro-imperialist views.
In 2019, French Parliament controversially and incorrectly equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, and they are currently reviewing a proposal to fully criminalize anti-Zionism.
They're saying straight, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Therefore, any criticism of Zionism, any criticism of Israel, means you are a criminal because you're an anti-Semite. And so it's killing all debate. Now, all throughout the collective West, but especially in France, the number one threat to freedom of speech is the Zionist movement and the pro-Israeli movement. And I weigh my words because it's very, very dangerous to say something like that in France because you'll find yourself in court.
Since October 7th, support for Hamas and even support for Palestine is often being prosecuted as so-called apology for terrorism. Pro-Palestinian demonstrations were banned nationwide for weeks, leading to thousands of fines on protesters, with protesters arrested and prosecuted for apology for terrorism for as little as carrying a Palestinian flag. Without the ability to openly criticize the policies of Israel, many believe it's difficult to imagine that Paris will reduce its unconditional support for Tel Aviv, no matter how many atrocities and war crimes they commit against Palestinians. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
South Korea's progressives extended their majority in the National Assembly in an election largely seen as a repudiation of conservative President Yoon Suk-yeol and his People Power Party. Democratic Party leader Lee Jae-myung promised to work for the greater good.
The ruling and opposition parties must work together to solve livelihood problems. We will spearhead the efforts to overcome the livelihood crisis. I once again express deep gratitude to the South Korean people.
Many South Koreans feel President Yoon has been overstepping his powers with a series of missteps and controversial measures, including the failure to resolve an ongoing doctor's strike.
There were too many cases where this government pushed through policies that made no sense, as if it were a dictatorship.
While the vote revolved around Yoon and the economy, with problems such as a lack of affordable housing and increasing polarization, Yoon's foreign policy latitude will also be curtailed.
This is really bad news for President Yoon. He's going to have an extremely hard time getting anything through the National Assembly. And what's more, it may jeopardize some of his great relations that he's formed with the U.S. and Japan during his presidency.
A new progressive party launched by Cho Guk, a former justice minister, won 12 seats in the assembly, further tipping the scales against President Yoon and his People Power Party.
The two-thirds majority enjoyed by progressives in the assembly will enable them to fast-track legislation and push their liberal agenda. Meanwhile, President Yoon's pro-business reforms stand little chance of becoming law, with Yoon something of a lame duck for the final 3 years of his five-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has released a new statement following Sunday's drone attack on Russian-held Zaporizhzhia power plant in eastern Ukraine. Tajani said the risk of creating a new Chernobyl must be averted and that a free zone around the nuclear plant must be immediately declared. He also advised against fighting in the vicinity of the nuclear plant. A few days ago, during a celebration for the 75th NATO anniversary, Tajani hinted at the possibility of resuming ties with Russia in the future.
We are not at war with Russia. We criticize Moscow's policies, but we are not at war with the Russian people, and we definitely intend to resume relations with the Russian people.
It is the first time Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, the largest in Europe, has been targeted in military action since November 2022. On Tuesday, Russia blamed Ukraine for launching drone attacks on the plant for a third day, but Ukraine denied an involvement.
The Italian Foreign Ministry's position on the nuclear plant attack is very interesting. Rome, for the first time since the start of the conflict in Ukraine, is not just taking the side of Kiev, but it is pragmatically looking at the interests of the whole of Europe, without focusing on who is to blame for the attack.
Also on Tuesday, the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell reiterated a warning that the UN's atomic watchdog IAEA issued earlier this week. Borrell said the reckless drone attack in Zaporizhzhia increases the risk of a dangerous nuclear accident. Italy has often reaffirmed its unwavering support for Ukraine, despite Russia's warning against such moves. The Italian government has so far approved 6 military support packages to Kiev, inclusive of both lethal and non-lethal equipment and specialized military training activities. Max Civili, Rome.
As India prepares to hold the world's largest electoral exercise from April 19, the main opposition National Congress Party has said the country will lose its secular democratic credentials if the ruling BJP attains power another term, accusing Prime Minister Modi's party of dictatorship. In its election manifesto, the party has promised to boost social spending, saying Modi's ruling party has favored the interests of only the rich. The opposition party promised to uplift the marginalized if it comes to power. Pre-election polls, however, predict Modi sweeping back for a third term. Election results will be declared on June 4th.
Most Indians have realized that only Congress Party can do good for poor and minorities, which is what democracy means. The country is divided today due to politics of division just for votes.
India's main opposition party, which ruled the country for decades, has been struggling to compete with Modi's ruling BJP, which mainly counts on country's largest Hindu majority population for its vote share. The Congress Party, while releasing its election manifesto, has promised more help for the marginalized, including assured jobs for young, improving farmers' income and better health insurance payouts. The Congress Party accused Modi's BJP of threatening the Constitution.
Our party has been crippled using tax agencies. Is it level playing ground? This is not only Congress Party. They will also do same with media houses. So we need to save democracy and constitution. We have to unite against autocratic policies of the BJP government.
Accusing Modi's BJP of crippling his party by freezing its bank account in tax dispute, the opposition party manifesto has vowed to undo BJP policies if the party comes to power, promising that all anti-people laws passed by the ruling BJP without proper democratic process will thoroughly be reviewed and changed, including a much-debated electoral bond controversy. The party is sure to address issues related to minorities, communal conflicts, mob lynching and cattle killings, bulldozer politics and suppression of human rights and shrinking dissent. The Congress Party, the main challenger to the BJP, hopes to mount a challenge to Modi's BJP by joining hands with regional parties. The ruling party has, however, downplayed Congress Party's manifesto as a bundle of lies, saying they ruled for 50 years, which is now a divided house of leaders working for personal interests.
In 2014, Modi's ruling BJP gained popularity among India's Hindu majority, promising revolutionary changes in the country, including a crackdown on corruption and economic prosperity. Critics, however, argue another term for the ruling BJP would undermine India's status as a secular democracy, as the ruling party's broader agenda is to transform India into a Hindu supremacist nation. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kHz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 23, 2015 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, the day when we entered into the nuclear negotiations. We had an acceptable and important advantage. We felt that we were entering the arena with a strong hand. Our advantage on that day was that we had managed to produce 20% uranium while we were under sanctions, and while all nuclear powers have refused to give us 20% uranium for the Tehran Research Center. On that day, we needed radiopharmaceuticals. Then, we managed to turn this 20% uranium into fuel plates and to use it. The other side was stunned. There is a long story about this, which many of you may be aware of. During a series of long negotiations, they did not agree to give us, that is to say, sell us, 20% uranium, and they did not allow anyone else to sell it to us either. As a result, we said that we would produce it inside the country.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Our youth, our scientists, and the group of people inside the country who are diligent, optimistic, and self-confident managed to astonish the other side, and thus they produced 20% uranium. And you know that, perhaps, I have said this on another occasion as well. In the process of nuclear enrichment, the important and difficult part is moving from 3-4% towards 20%. Reaching the 90% phase from the 20% phase is a very simple move. When someone obtains 20%, the other phases will be easy. The difficult and important part is the part from 3-5 to 20%. Our youth managed to take this difficult path. They produced 20% uranium and fuel plates. This was one of our achievements and advantages. We entered the negotiations with this morale, the strategy of resistance and persistence in the face of pressures worked. The Americans acknowledged that sanctions do not have any effect, as was pointed out in this meeting. This is a completely correct analysis. The Americans reached the conclusion that sanctions do not produce the desired effect anymore.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. Guided me from all the ways.
choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesti. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran, in an impressive display of strength, accuracy, and technological prowess, sent hundreds of drones and missiles towards the Zionist-occupied territories during its retaliatory operation against the regime. Despite the Iron Dome and help from the United States, the UK, France, and Jordan in shooting down the drones, the Iranian missiles hit their targets, which were two bases, the Nevatim military base and the Ramon Air Base, were hit with accuracy. Now, the paradigm in the region has been changed. What does it mean for the regime, the region, and the world? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Montreal, Yves Englert, author and political activist. And out of Brussels, Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst. Well, thank you both for being with me. I'm going to start this off in Montreal. And Yves, well, Iran's retaliatory operation was initiated due to the Israeli regime's attack on Iran's consular section of the embassy in Damascus on April the 1st. Now, Tehran has cited Article 51, the Charter of the United Nations, and its right to self-defense. Your assessment of Iran's right to have carried out this strike?
Well, I'm not a lawyer or an expert in international law, but clearly Israel violated Iranian sovereignty in murdering a number of Iranian officials, including top generals, 2 weeks ago. And Israel has, of course, killed many Iranians in Syria over recent years, and also even is alleged to have been behind a whole series of operations within Israel or within Iran that have killed different officials over the years. So I think that it's clear that Israel violated international law, and it seems at least a plausible argument that Iran had the right, according to international law, to respond to Israel's aggression. So I again, I'm not a lawyer, but it. On the surface of it, it seems that Iran obviously had a right to respond to Israel's crass, brazen violation of international law.
Okay. Well, Gilbert, there are major attempts now to downplay the success of Iran's True Promise operation. What is your perspective regarding the operation and the overall effectiveness of the strike?
I think the operation has to be looked at two levels, tactical and strategic. If it's a tactical level, at a minimum, the Iranian attack provided important intelligence information to Iran on the components and location of those components in the Israeli Iron Dome and air defense levels, because they have several different systems in operation. At the tactical level, the mission was disputed. As you have noted, that Iran claimed success in hitting its two military objects that were essential to its retaliatory response, whereas Western media tend to ignore or even to deny that any significant damage was done. That remains to be appraised in the future. However, the very fact that Iran responded in this way, in the first time ever in its history, has directly struck the territory of Israel, that sent a message through the whole community in the Middle East, which has a strategic level of importance, namely the clear warning that Iran issued and that has to be taken seriously given the actions of this past weekend, is the warning that it made to other Gulf states, that, and in particular states which are home to American military bases and operational centers, such as Bahrain is. And these warnings were that if you facilitate the counterattack that one may expect or think will happen from Israel in response to this weekend's massive drone and ballistic missile and cruise missile attack on Israel, if you facilitate an Israeli response, we will bomb you. The fact is that none of the players in the Middle East wants to be brought into the war directly. And so what has happened as a consequence of this exercise by Iran, a limited exercise over the weekend, is that the neighbors are withdrawing their permission for the United States to operate and to use the airspace of these countries to support Israel in any future counterattack. Now, that is something that Iran has strived to achieve over decades, and it seems to have been achieved in one weekend. So at a tactical level, there may be disputes over what was actually done on the ground. There is no dispute that Iran showed it is capable of self-confident in pursuing a military confrontation with Israel, if that is what has to happen. And at a strategic level, it has changed the game in the Middle East because all the neighboring states have backed away from the United States.
Okay, well, Yves, no country has dared to attack inside of the Israeli regime to the Western hegemonic front's unwavering support for the regime, but Iran chose to do it and has been effective. Now, your thoughts on the overall attack, and is it a game changer? Iran was able to penetrate several layers of defense from the regime itself and also from the United States, France, the UK, and Jordan. That in itself is extremely effective. Your thoughts?
Well, I agree with my co-panelists' assessment to a large extent. I think this is significant. There's a kind of two different angles being done in the Canadian and Western media. On one hand, saying that Iran has drastically escalated things, and then at the same time saying that Iran has been unsuccessful, which is a little bit in contradiction with each other. Whether this is going to be a game changer for the region, I'm a little bit hesitant on that front. I think that I'm made scared by the situation, because I think that there really are fanatics in charge of the Israeli government and military, and I think that even if the U.S. and others have tried to warn Israel to not do something really crazy in response, I think there's a decent chance that the Netanyahu government will do a launch something that is a huge escalation from an already tense situation, and that could spiral into something even bigger. But I think that to me the hope here is that Israel is restrained in terms of its response to Iran, and also that Israel and the other countries in the region that have, you know, like Jordan, for instance, that, you know, helped shoot down drones, that this puts a whole lot of pressure on that government to do more to end the genocide in Gaza, and that the Israel is put more on the back foot in its policy in Gaza. But at this point, I don't think it's clear, you know, what the Israeli reaction is going to be, and if the most crazy elements of the Israeli government will be restrained.
Okay, well, Gilbert, Iran says its goals of the operation were deterring, punishing, and warning the Zionist regime. Do you think that it reached its goals?
I think it has. Well, of course, we'll know in the coming days whether the Israeli government acts rationally or pursues an emotional response that is self-destructive. It has been stated in the Western press that the Iranian attack was the largest in scale use of drones and other missiles to at a single day. This was 320 or something like that, objects, missiles and other objects sent away to Israel. However, let's look at the numbers. This is a numbers game. And you have to consider that the potential of Iran to deliver a devastating, or more than one devastating attack on the very compact geography of Israel is overwhelmingly clear. The numbers of missiles in the Iranian inventory, including the most recent, most modern, and most destructive missiles that number several thousand, can be as many as 10,000. So in this respect, what happened over the weekend was only indicative and a warning of what can come. There is no way that a massive, genuinely massive, missile strike against Israel can be turned back by an Iron Dome or any other air defense system. So in this context, any action by Israel that wants to be a macho is going to be self-destructive.
Okay, well, your thoughts about that, Eves, because if, according to Gilbert, if the Israeli regime understands that any action they will take will be self-destructive, because I want to go back to what you said and when you talked about the regime and the possibility of actually now them initiating an attack. But how logical would that be when even Iran has not used its more sophisticated missiles, but still were able to penetrate? Now, Iran is saying that it did not want to cause any major damage. It wanted to send a message, and it sent that message by hitting those two bases. It also did not want to hit any civilian areas, which perhaps can be a lesson for the Israeli regime. Your thoughts on that side of things?
Well, I think the Israelis are caught, because the Israelis want to this you know, psycho power that unleashes far more destruction on anyone else than is ever committed on them is part of their whole raison d'être, the how they operate. And obviously we see that in Gaza, that, you know, in response to the October 7th, they feel the need to demonstrate how violent and try to scare the whole region. So Israel wants to operate like that. So I think the general ethos from the Israeli government is going to be to respond in that way. And also, I think the fact that they are failing in their stated objectives in Gaza, in that they haven't got the hostages and Hamas is still able to operate, that makes them want to lash out even more. But I agree that the likely response, if Israel does go, let's call it crazy in its response to Iran, then there's going to be a lot of damage in Israel. And the Israeli public is you know, their little bubble's going to burst. The reality is even despite October 7th, Israelis have lived a fairly quiet existence while occupying and brutalizing Palestinians. But I wouldn't put it past the Netanyahu government to pursue something that's on the very escalatory side of a response. I would assume there's going to be some response from Israel. I don't think Israel is going to be able to not respond in any way. I think the Israeli military and the Israeli government are caught in a difficult position from their standpoint, in that they want to be the bully that gets to do all the killing and gets to do all the damage and not have any impact or very little impact on Israeli society. And now they've been confronted with the fact that much of Israel could be destroyed if they try to keep up that bully posture.
Well, Gilbert, Iran has said that they have not shown the most of their ability. They just wanted to send this message and serve as a deterrent. However, that if the Israeli regime continues with its aggression, that it will definitely respond in much harsher ways inside of the regime. Your thoughts about, first of all, what Iran is saying, and second of all, how likely can that serve as a deterrent in itself?
Well, the Israelis are very dependent on the United States and other allies to enable their very powerful armed forces to maintain that posture of strength. And as the warning of Iran regarding how it will behave should there be a forceful Israeli response to this latest weekend's events, that has, as I said, frightened the neighborhood and sobered up the neighborhood so that they are stepping away from the United States. But Mr. Biden has urged caution on Israel is not a matter of his humanitarian disposition. It is a realization that American bases in the neighborhood are hostage to Israeli actions. And the head of the regional operational center for the United States is under threat. The base of the Fifth Fleet is under threat, under massive threat that Iran can carry out, depending on what the Israelis do next. Now, if we have to look at what the Israelis would like to do, what Netanyahu would like to do, we don't have to guess. He has talked about it for the last 5 or 10 years. He would like to destroy the alleged Iranian nuclear program, that is, weaponry. And here, Mr. Netanyahu is totally dependent on American support, because the facilities in Iran are at a great distance from Israel, and Israeli planes can achieve missions only with the help of American tanker planes. Mr. Biden would have to then be in the midst of any Israeli attack, and it's hardly credible that he will do that now, given the vulnerability of American assets in the region. So what Israelis could do, how they could realize their dreams, it is unforeseeable. It is improbable that their dreams can be fulfilled and that they can do damage of a great significance to Iran. Iran is vastly larger. It is 10 times bigger population. It is inconceivable that Israel could deliver a damage to Iran that would not be immediately turned into destruction of Israel. So I think that however hot heads may exist in the Israeli cabinet, and there are at least two of them who are quite prominent in their rabid remarks, I don't think that they can prevail against the common sense and the sense of self-preservation of their colleagues.
What are your thoughts, Yves, on the significance of the United States not getting involved and coming so far to the aid of the Zionists to attack Iran? Gilbert pointed out some points, but I'd like to hear your perspective.
Well, the U.S. did help in shooting down and destroying some of the drones and missiles. So the U.S. has provided help, and they, of course, provide innumerable forms of support to the Israeli military at all times, and intelligence and weapons, et cetera, et cetera. Whether they will directly enable Israel to strike nuclear facilities in Iran, I would venture to guess they won't. I agree with that. We don't know. The U.S. tried to say they had no role in the attack on April 1st. I don't know if that's correct or not. In a direct sense, it may be correct, but indirectly, there's so many ways in which they enabled Israeli military, and also the fact that they failed to condemn the attack. A sort of tacit endorsement of what Israel did. I think the U.S. is divided. Also, I think this is one of the things that Israel obviously wants to draw the U.S. into fighting Iran as much as possible. And I don't think it's just around destroying a alleged nuclear program. I think they would probably like Israel would like to see the U.S. just destroy Iran generally, and certainly destroy as much of its military as possible. I still think that Biden is so wildly pro-Israel, and there's so many of the upper echelons of his administration that are so wildly pro-Israel that and so much of the Republican and the political culture in the U.S. is so pro-Israel. I think there's still a possibility here that Israel does something very aggressive in its response, and the U.S. is sucked into defending Israel and fighting Iran in a more kind of direct sense. So I think that's definitely a possibility. And there's just so many ways in which all that can escalate too. I mean, the more bombings in Syria, and there's obviously Russian forces in Syria, and you can draw in obviously Hezbollah will be part of this. But there's a lot of ways in which this can escalate quite quickly. But I don't think that I wouldn't put it past the fact that the Biden administration will end up being directly involved against Iran on behalf of Israel.
And your thoughts, Gilbert, of where this could go? Because on the one hand, we have the resistance front and their allies. We're looking at, of course, the traditional resistance front, and we also have with Russia and China now coming out and supporting Iran's right to initiate that retaliatory attack. I mean, your overall assessment of where this can go at this point in time?
Well, it can go in all directions, and it can take us to a very dramatic change in global economics. Iran has many possibilities of defending itself and imposing enormous pain on those who attack it. The last week, we all learned about the taking of a merchant vessel, container vessel, Israeli owned, in the Straits of Hormuz, and it's being directed to Iranian port. The Straits of Hormuz are under close watch of Iran, which has ground to naval vessel attack missiles capable of closing the straits and strangling the global movement of natural gas and oil. That is to say, the amount of pain that any of Iran's enemies can think of imposing on Iran is held in check by the reality of the pain that Iran can impose on the world at large. So I am skeptical that this will go off in a wild direction, since all parties are aware of what I just said. However, tit for tat at a less than awful level are foreseeable or possible, and I sincerely hope that the conflict will remain contained.
Okay. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me here on the Spotlight. Eve Zinkler, author and political activist out of Montreal. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst out of Brussels. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kHz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio